I went for a walk and went off-piste a little bit and just found mountains of plastic bottles, which was quite horrifying. And then another area, when I was on the way down, I could smell burning, so they were obviously trying to burn it, which again isn't very good for the environment.
Hikers, welcome to the Distance Hiker podcast. I am your host, Matthew, and it's fantastic to have you on the show with me today. Wherever you are in the world, whatever you're doing, I hope you're having a fantastic January. I hope it's not been too much of a post-Christmas, post-New Year drag for you. I know these months can be hard for a lot of people, but make sure you get out, you look after yourself, you find the time to do the things you love, even if the daylight hours are smaller and reduced, and it can feel a little bit of a drag, but look after yourself. I know I've not been doing much of that recently, and talking to you about that is very much my promise to myself that I'm going to do just the same. So if you're on the same boat and you're just feeling a bit deflated, a bit meh, then this is your calling to do something about it with me. Let me know how you are. Drop me an email. Tell me how January is going. I'm all ears. I love talking to listeners of the show. So if you're new here, welcome. If this is your first episode, then thank you so much for being here and being a part of the show, being a highly valued listener, because you really are. And the Distance Hiker podcast is your dedicated show for all things long distance hiking. And of course, traveling on foot. So this is where I share stories of long distance hikers and change makers within our wonderful and unique community. But before I introduce today's guest, I just wanted to remind you that if you enjoy the show and the free content I put out, I want to be paid. I do. I want to be paid, not by money. No. I don't want your money. I want subscribers and reviews. It means the world to me if you do subscribe and review. You can subscribe on Spotify and rate on Spotify and leave a review and subscribe on Apple. Doing this hopefully takes you no time at all. And I get how it works. You're driving to work, listening to the show in the car, and you get to work and you forget to subscribe. I know, I do the same all the time for all these podcasts that are telling me that I need to do the same. But it takes 2 seconds just to open up your phone and to press the subscribe button. Give me some reviews, whether you like it or not, review it. I'd love to know. And it just helps to push the show, allows me to reach more people, allows us to spread the long distance hiking love, because we all feel the benefits of doing this. And I just want more people to enjoy long distance hiking and get that wonderful benefit of following the trails. So that's enough about that. On to today's show. I've got Davina Faria with me. Now, Davina is a long-distance hiker. She also works for herself with a company that enables her to have time freedom, which is very much the theme of today's show. And I was really keen to talk to her because she had two contrasts to her life. The first part was an experience where she just didn't get out much. She didn't have the time or resource to be able to go and do the things she loved doing, which was long distance hiking and having that freedom just to drop everything and enjoy the stuff she loved. And then she engineered her life to enable her to get out and do more trails, more trips, more ski holidays, all the things she loved, and to become a yes person. And that was down to the work that she chose, the intentional way in which she chose her work to ensure that she could have that freedom and life and the lifestyle she wanted. I found it a really fascinating podcast. It was really inspiring to hear a story of somebody who just has the time to do something that she wants to do. It's nothing particularly revolutionary that she does for her work, but it's interesting nonetheless, and it allows her to do what we all want to do, which is just go hiking more. So I think you'll enjoy this episode if you're the kind of person who simply wishes you had more time to do the things you love. And this episode should hopefully be inspiring and eye-opening for you and seeing what's possible. So without further ado, I introduce you to Davina Farrier on the Distance Hiker podcast, episode 32. Davina, whereabouts in the country are you based?
I actually live in two places.
Oh, fantastic.
The reason is I actually live and my house is in Bedford.
Okay.
And I've lived there for years. Yep. But currently, right now, I'm in Bude in Cornwall.
Amazing.
So I've got two places. Right now, I'm in a static caravan I bought last year.
Ah, oh, fantastic.
And that's why I'm here. So, yeah. And I absolutely love it here. It's,
oh, I bet.
Part of my story is a return to Cornwall.
Yes.
And I'll explain that.
Okay, brilliant. So Bedfordshire and Bude in Cornwall. I'm sure that, well, I'm pretty envious of that. That sounds amazing. So you're on a static caravan. How is static caravan living? Are you kind of there half the year? Do you go on the weekends? How does it work for you with that?
I'm actually trying to live here mainly in the winter. Because
okay.
I left
oh, wow.
it out.
Controversial. Most people spend the summers in static caravans.
No, I absolutely love the winter. Today was beautiful. I went out with my thick coat on and everything, but it was so lovely. It's actually really calm. I've not seen it that calm before. But just the, to me, the sunsets, the reflections, it's just stunning. No crowds.
Yeah.
I love
oh, yeah. So you get Cornwall at its best, where it's kind of raw, rugged, wintry, kind of and quiet.
Yes, definitely.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And is the caravan, my assumption, so when I was younger, my grandmother had a caravan back down on the Sussex coastline, about half a mile from West Wittering. And we used to spend our summers down there. But during the winter, the campsite or the caravan site closed. So I never really got to experience a caravan in the winter, but my assumption was, and continues to be, it closed because caravans are too cold in the winter. Is that, and to be fair, this one probably was because it was really old. It was a tin box. But is your caravan cold in the winter?
No, to be honest, it's actually a static caravan, so it's different. Thankfully, the site I'm on is a 12-month site, which is why I bought it. But no, it's like a small flat. It's got fast central heating. It's got, you know, everything, all the mod cons in the kitchen. It's got obviously dishwasher, washing machine, fridge, freezer, all the equipment. It's got three separate departments. So it's got my lounge area, which is my relaxing kitchen area, where I work as well. And then the bedroom and two bathrooms. No, it's a luxury small flat, basically.
Amazing. So home from home. That sounds really, really interesting. So, yeah, a bit jealous of the caravan. That's awesome. A really nice way to spend a winter. It's got to be, you know, nice just to get away from home and things and just have a bit of a different winter and avoid the that there's often a feeling in winter, where, particularly with me, where I start to feel a little bit down in the dumps. I think that change of weather does that. And I actually think the idea of having somewhere else you can go to kind of flip that on its head and switch up your life for winter and go somewhere else sounds really interesting, even if that's in the same country. So
yeah,
I'm sure it's a really welcome escape for you.
Yeah, definitely. And I let the caravan out in the summer mainly to pay the fees.
yeah, brilliant. So cost neutral. That's amazing. So you moved when you were younger with your parents to Cornwall anyway. So you're kind of from Cornwall. So I think let's start there. So tell me a little about kind of your childhood around that time where you moved to Cornwall. Where were you before?
Prior to that, I was in Surrey. I was led a very sheltered life. My parents don't really know what they're... Well, my dad was a scientist, but I went to private school and didn't really... we used to go on holidays, but didn't really explore that much. Not that I remember anyway. For some reason, I have very little memory of my childhood, certainly below the age of 10. But what I do remember was very happy. And then my parents wanted to, I suppose, live the dream like we all do. So when they got the opportunity, they decided to move down to Cornwall, right down the Lizard, which is a little bit remote. But they bought a shop, they were going to buy a caravan site, and they were going to do a craft market. At the time, the caravan site fell through, the craft market fell through, but they still bought the shop. What didn't quite give them the lifestyle they wanted, because it was sold newspapers, and if you sell newspapers, you have to be there 24/7. Or not 24/7, but 30 every day. So yeah, I moved down there when I was 14 and thrown into a different type of school, went to the biggest comprehensive school in the country, and that was a bit of a shock.
Yeah. From private school, yeah.
Yeah, but it also gave me masses of opportunity, which I didn't have at the other school. And I suppose really that's where my start of my outdoor life was. I'm not saying I learned to run, but that's where I learned I was good at running. So I started doing cross country and the 1500 and running for the school. And that got me outside, really. So that's what I did quite a lot.
Amazing. So you in Cornwall, your parents were really trying to kind of do what a lot of people do, which is just really reset things and just have a complete change of pace. Now, from reading through your notes that you sent to me, it wasn't too long after until you did have some tragedy in your life. Are you okay to share that?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, unfortunately, literally within a couple of years, my dad became really quite ill. And it turned out he had asbestosis from the blue asbestos. I can never pronounce it, so I'll just stick it as that. But yeah, we didn't know that that's what he had. But what we do know is actually moving to Cornwall triggered it off.
Okay.
Because Cornwall is lovely, but it's damp and it's warm. Mm-hmm. And if you've got any lung issues, that can exasperate that.
Okay,
and so that's what we found happened with my dad. And so... Right. They thought it was pleurisy, and then unfortunately, literally, he passed away within 2.5 years of us moving down there.
Wow.
So he never got to...
That must have been really difficult for you and for your family with, you know, that change, and then suddenly there's another kind of tragic change not too long afterwards.
Definitely. And for my mum, it was devastating because they were soulmates, but also having to deal with two teenage girls.
Yeah.
And that transition wasn't easy for her nor for us either.
How did you deal with that then at the time?
I was quite shocked because I didn't realise Dad was ill until I had a row with my mum, and then she sort of told me literally 3 days before he died.
Oh,
but
wow. Okay.
Yeah, I think as children you do tend to cope quite quickly. But my biggest regret is I never knew my dad as an adult, you know, because you always see your dad as someone you look up to, and that's always going to be there. But you don't ever have that adult conversation with him being a, you know, another person and exploring all of that. And that's probably the biggest thing I missed, especially as I did get on better with my dad rather than my mum.
Okay. And at the so in dealing with that, you mentioned in your notes that from the age of 22, you then went on a round the world backpacking trip. Was that triggered by a sort of delayed response to wanting to process your father's death, or a sort of sense of, well, life is short, I need to just get on and do something different? Because a lot of 22-year-olds, you know, don't do that. And you actually even recently haven't had the opportunity to do that. And it's a bold move to go on a round the world backpacking trip for a year. So what kind of triggered that? Because that's obviously a very outdoorsy thing to do at that particular age. So where was kind of the story behind that?
Definitely. Well, there were two things which triggered it. Definitely my dad passing away, because it really hit me, as we've had recently with the COVID situation, that you just don't know what's around the corner. So I wanted to create some really good memories. My mum and dad had plenty of, I'm not saying opportunity, they wanted to create those memories after my sister and I had left home and didn't get opportunity. So for me, it was really important to just grab whatever opportunity came along. But the actual main trigger for me going on that round the world trip was not getting a place on Operation Rally. So I'm one of those. I know, I'm one of those people that if I don't get something, I want to show you and prove you that I can do it.
Oh, okay. Did you ever manage to do that afterwards, or did you?
No, I think we have one opportunity, and I think once I decided to do my round the world trip, that desire wasn't there as much, because I'd sort of done it on my own rather than encompassed under a sort of as a group of people, which would have been absolutely lovely. But so the two factors really triggered it. But I left after my dad died, I knew I was struggling with my A-levels. So that really did affect me. And then my mum said to me, why don't you just apply for this job and get some experience? And before I know it, I got offered the job. So it was at Culdrose in Cornwall, and I decided to take it. I was still able to study part-time, so I felt I could grow that. And so, yes, I worked 5 years, so before I went travelling. So I was able to build up an income or some money basically behind me. I'd moved from Cornwall by that stage up to Hertfordshire. And then I decided, 22, that was the time I was going. There was one friend fell out, as in she was going to come with me and didn't. And then another one chose to. And yeah, the two of us went off.
So where did you go? What did you do on the backpacking trip?
So in those days, I don't know what's around nowadays, but I went on one of these, bought the round the world air ticket where you could go to as many places as long as you kept in the same direction.
Okay, I see.
We crammed in as many airports and plane rides as we could. But literally, we started off in Rome, and then we went to Bahrain. That was interesting because my geography wasn't very hot and we ended up in the wrong place. But thankfully, we were went to the embassy and some kind person put us up. And in fact, it was the vicar. And we ended up helping him by being witnesses at a local wedding. And actually, we were in touch with those people for quite a long time afterwards, which was nice. And then we went across Southeast Asia, which was amazing, for about 3 months. And then into Australia, where I had to work to try and get some money and tried different types of jobs. It was a lot easier then. Obviously, I had my working visa, so that was good. And then went to New Zealand for 5 weeks, and then across the ocean and Fiji, and then ended up in Canada and then to the States. And it's amazing how things happen. I don't know how it happened, but I ended up having a pen pal for a period of time. Most people wouldn't know what that is now, but I've never had it before or since. But that pen pal for probably only 6 months led to meeting up with them in Canada and having the most amazing experience in the Rocky Mountains with people who then introduced us to other people, which you find a lot happens on the long distance hiking as well.
Yeah, of course. So you build up a bit of community. That's fascinating, actually. And I don't know what today's version of a pen pal would be, if even people do pen pals anymore. I don't know if how that would work. Pen, you know, an email pal. But I think that's a really, really interesting story. And obviously that kind of really kickstarted your love for travel at that point. So coming back from that trip round with the round the world ticket for a year, you then got on with a career in sales, if I'm right.
Yes.
And then went down the sort of family route, which very much I'm on at the moment. And you still had those itchy feet. So I want to talk about that a little bit, because that's a bit of an interesting bit you mentioned there. As a mother and having itchy feet, you've got that conflict of you need to be grounded and in present and in the same place for your kids and create a sense of stability. That's a normal feeling to have. But then you've also got this urge for adventure and travel on the side. How did you deal with those two conflicting feelings and worlds?
That's really interesting, Matthew.
There's lots of ways to do that, I must add, but I'm really interested in what your kind of approach was.
Well, unfortunately, I probably compromised too much. And the reason why I'm doing what I'm doing now is a direct result of having, I'm going to use the word sacrificed. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be with my children, having decided to have them. I would have loved to have done some more adventure-y things, but my husband or ex-husband wasn't interested. I did used to take them camping as much as possible and, you know, going on little adventures with them. But but when my eldest was 14, that led me into my first proper long distance hiking. So that was the one balance I did do. But up until that time, unfortunately, other than a few camping trips, it was really held back, and I was frustrated.
Yeah, I'm going to say, so you kind of mentally struggle with that, I guess, because that frustration, if you're not able to exercise that sense of adventure you have, it never leaves you, does it?
No.
You know, I've had periods in my life where, you know, mainly down to poor communication between me and my partner, where I've not kind of said actually what I want. And when I have quite recently, she's gone, yeah, of course you can go hiking more. So I do now. but, you know, if you don't have that in your relationship or your life, it can really fester and build, and you kind of, it's almost this urge to go out the door and do it, but then you're held back and you can't. So I can imagine that's really difficult. But so you had that first experience of walking long distances when your kids, you say, they were 14.
Yeah, so 14 and 12, my youngest isn't the slightest bit interested in any form of walking. He's extremely sporty, but he has to be a challenge or teamwork. So walking for the sake of walking is sort of a waste of time. Yeah, what's the point? And his dad was the same, to be honest. But I decided to walk from Land's End to the Lizard over a week, and my 14-year-old was quite happy to come with me. So he said, yeah, that'd be fine. So that was a really nice bonding exercise. And he's the adventure one out of the two of them. And he still is now happy to come with me on various things, which is great. It's lovely.
Brilliant. What did that unlock for you doing that first walk then? Obviously, it allowed you to have that freedom and realize, oh, I can actually do these things with my kids as well, with one of my kids. But did it sort of open up your world then at that point a little bit more, where you just thought, well, screw it, I'm going to do more? Because looking again at your notes, I can see it wasn't long afterwards that you, you know, your marriage, as you wrote, fell apart. So how did that kind of fall together, where that feeling of being trapped kind of loosened, and you could then were able to spread your wings and start doing things again that you wanted to do?
Well, going back to the Southwest Coastal Path when I first started, although to be honest at the time I didn't even know it had a name. To me, it was just walking from Land's End to the Lizard where I lived. So I was part of that was to take my son to show him where I lived, and it was nice to be able to walk there and be outside. The following year, I went from the Lizard to Mevagissey, and then the following year, Mevagissey to Plymouth. So there were those 3 years. So I did at least do that and get out and about. And so that fulfilled some of my adventures. So at least I did something. We used to go skiing, and that was also I need to be outside. But and we did a little bit when the kids were young, but not that much. Finances, unfortunately. It's just a very expensive hobby.
Yeah,
but yeah, so then I was given the opportunity after my marriage started going down, where financially it's only me to do it rather than have to finance 2, 3, or 4 people to do it. So it did make it a lot easier for me to just say, I'm now going. So when someone offered me to go to my first proper hike, I would say, was Everest Base Camp.
Oh, amazing.
He said to me, or this group I was with said, do you fancy going? And I said, well, yeah, okay. Never been on my bucket list, but it's one of those things which if someone gives me an opportunity and it sounds like a good idea and I think I can do it, I'll just say yes. So that's what I did. And it was an amazing experience. And then
tell me about Everest Base Camp, first of all. So what does it involve? Why was it an amazing experience? Because I know it's a bucket list item for many people. Is it worth doing?
Distance Hiker Trail prints are beautifully designed pieces of trail-inspired artwork created to be proudly displayed in your home. We are developing two distinct styles of prints, from a black and white map-based print to a more colourful minimalist route outline, and have big plans to bring you a vast collection of long-distance hiking-inspired artwork over the next year. This very much is my focus alongside the podcast. Better still, we are donating 5% off the sale of each print back to the trail associated with the print. So, if you buy a coast-to-coast trail print, 5% of that sale amount goes back to the maintenance of that trail, so straight to that trail association or the national trails or whichever body manages the trails and accepts donations. 5% will go back to that. So your print is making a direct impact to the maintenance of the long distance trails, preserving them for hikers following in your footsteps and future generations to come. We are adding new designs each week, and if you don't find the trail print you want, just reach out to me and I'll get one made up for you at no extra charge. Visit distancehiker.com/shop to choose your trail print today, and as a regular listener of the podcast, simply enter podcast into the discount code box at checkout to get 20% when you purchase 2 trail prints in one transaction. That's podcast to get 20% for 2 purchased trail prints. And of course, free postage is available on all orders. Thank you for listening. Now back to the show.
It is. So yes, you have to prepare yourself or be prepared for the altitude issue, because obviously you are going up to 5,500 meters. So you fly into Kathmandu and usually have a couple of days there, and then you get a teeny weeny aircraft to Lukla, which is a bit of a dodgy.
This is that really dangerous airport with a really short runway, yeah.
Yes. So once you're there and feel safe and landed, everything's okay. So then, yeah, we had a guide. We had a really good guide. So really, you're just in their hands and you're trusting them. And they tell you when to get up and off you go. So thankfully, you don't have to carry your stuff because, although I would be prepared to now, but in those days, even though it was only a few years ago, but my first experience, I wasn't going to be carrying stuff up all those hills. As I was doing the Southwest Coastal Path, there was a lot of similarity because the Everest Base Camp is a lot of up and down, and down, because all the crossings are when you go down the hill or down the mountain to cross over the river and then you're back up again. So, but the views were lovely. It surprisingly was quite desolate, like desert-like, and certainly no snow when we went. Until literally you got to, I'm going to say the top, but actually the bottom, the base camp. And when you then hit the glaciers and we'll be able to see that side of things as well. But yeah, it was just the mountains. I have a real affinity with mountains, but really dramatic mountains.
Yeah, of course.
So, which is why I like my whole skiing exercise. It's got that whole dramatic side to it. But it wasn't just it was the people you're with as well, and just really exploring and seeing the whole vision of what's available and just how big the world is. And then there was a bit of a grounding exercise because I can't remember exactly which part it was, but you hit one area where it's a memorial for all those people who died. Mm-hmm. So, and that's quite grounding.
So that's people who've died on Everest, attempting Everest,
which is quite harrowing really at times.
That's interesting. Was the base camp as you expected it to be then? Was it sort of this really busy kind of dirty smelly place, as kind of, because you can see pictures online, and I've never been, of, you know, Everest base camp, piles of rubbish, climbers everywhere. You know, was it that, or did you sort of, not at all?
I think maybe the time of year, because the window for people to go up is May.
Okay.
So there's a very short window when people can get up right to the top. So we went October, November, so there were no tents, and it was really quite clear. So yes, there were quite a few people doing the trek, but in terms of rubbish, in terms of tents, in terms of climbers, no, there was none of that. The only thing I was disappointed with, and hitting my consciousness with environmental, is the amount of plastic bottles, because the Sherpas take up tons and tons of bottles. And then I went for a walk and went off-piste a little bit and just found mountains of plastic bottles, which was quite horrifying. And then another area, when I was on the way down, I could smell burning. So they were obviously trying to burn it, which again, isn't very good for the environment.
this must be then the plastic bottles in season that are kind of stored along the route at tea houses and things that they just don't want to cart down. They're then obviously kind of chucked behind the hills somewhere so the tourists don't see it and then just burnt off.
Yeah, interesting.
Okay. And I guess that's the hidden side of tourism, isn't it, that you kind of forget about, is that, you know, there is, wherever there's tourism and a lot of it, there will be someone there who's trying to hide the things that tourists don't want to see, which is the piles of rubbish often, or, the, you know, the exploitation behind the scenes. And it's kind of interesting that as a tourist, you managed to go off piste enough to get a taste of that. You went off the kind of designated track. You didn't, you weren't meant to do that, Davina. That's, you know.
We'd finished about 2:30 in the afternoon, so you've got about 3 hours to kill. So I asked if anyone else wanted to walk with me, but they'd all had enough. So I just wandered off on my own, and that's where I found these heap or this big heap.
Interesting. Yeah, that's really, really interesting. Is a question, because I'm more interested in this, is it cold? Because you always think, oh, Everest region, you know, is going to be freezing cold. But at the same time, you obviously see pictures of people doing it in sort of shorts and t-shirts. I guess it varies from, you know, the time of year you go, but was it cold at that time when you went, or was it kind of manageable?
I'm going to say both, because when we started, we were in shorts and t-shirts. And because we went October and late, early November. So I'm not sure about shorts, but certainly t-shirts, and it was hot. So it was advisable to layer up. So by the time you got past Namsty, which was roughly 3,500 meters, it started getting cooler. And yes, at the top, yes, you had to have all six layers on and your hat and your gloves and everything. So it was across the whole range.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. So Everest Base Camp sounds amazing and sure as hell is on my bucket list. I'd love to do it. That or the Annapurna Trail, something in Nepal would be absolutely awesome to do as a long distance trek. And coming back from that, you decided then to do another walk, didn't you? So this is when you kind of decided to go and do the Southwest Coast Path again. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, no, definitely. Prior to that, my mum passed away and intended to go to South America. That was my plan, because I'd worked really hard during lockdown and it all went, you know, nothing was going to plan. I thought I just need to get away. So I'd made the decision April 21, I was going to go to South America and explore for about 6 months. Hadn't a clue. I was just going to turn up and just find out what's going to happen, really. So I was really excited about that. And then obviously lockdown happened and I had to change my plans. But I had always wanted to do the Southwest Coastal Path. And it was really in total. And it was in memory of my mum. So my mum lived in Clevedon and she introduced me to the business which I'm involved with, which gives that time freedom we were talking about.
Yeah.
And she also is buried with my dad down at the Lizard. So it was a bit of a pilgrimage, I would say, for me to walk from there. A couple of years previously, I'd planned to walk from Land's End to Clevedon to meet up with her. But due to her becoming ill, my divorce, all of that kind of thing, it just got shelved. So it was it was a bit of a pilgrimage.
Okay. So, and you did it all in one go in this instance, and you did it with you camped as you went around the coast path. Was this your first experience of doing a long distance trek carrying all your own kit and camping as you went?
Yes, totally. So the previous treks I'd done, both, you know, Land's End to Plymouth with my son and Everest Base Camp, were all, I'm going to call them, day packing or day hiking with your, you know, a nice bed at the end of it and someone else carrying your stuff a lot of the time. So that was great. But when I actually financed that, I added up the cost. I'm thinking, that's ridiculous.
It's expensive real quick, doesn't it? Once you start,
I can't afford that. And then on my own, it was going to be doubled purely because I was solo. So I was thinking, right, I now need to rethink. And I'll be honest, I was inspired by the book which everyone reads going on that path, which is the Salt Path.
Yeah, yeah.
And I read that with the intention initially to see what they thought about where I lived. So I was a bit disappointed because they didn't even mention where I lived. So it obviously was not important in their eyes.
Yeah, just passed by without a thought to put it in the book.
Yeah, yeah. Really, I thought. However, I thought, well, if they can do it, then I can lug a rucksack, even though they were 8 years younger than I was. So, you know, I was older than that. But like I said before, I'm one of these people, it's just... yeah, I'm going to give it a go. So, yes, I was trying to keep the weight down and I ended up choosing a rucksack, which actually wasn't the best one. And I did struggle with the weight initially and that caused loads of blisters and a few other things because my boots, which worked fine on Everest, ended up cracking. I hadn't realised, which meant water leaked in. And so I wasn't really prepared properly with my footwear, even though I'd walked hundreds of miles with them prior to that, and they never hurt, purely with the water situation. And that, plus my weight, plus the ups and downs of the start of that South West Coastal Path, wasn't very good at all. I was very fortunate that because I went from Clevedon first, that's actually quite flat until you get to Minehead. So I was able to walk those 100 miles with a little bit more ease. So it did ease me into it. And I think that was where I had the real bad blisters. But also the English weather, as we all have, which was storms and rain. And so that was all a bit of a shock, really. But it was really important for me to do this trip on my own. That was something I've never actually done anything on my own, particularly because whilst I didn't marry young, I met my husband quite young. I did my around the world trip with a friend. All the other things I'd done was with friends. So it was really important for me to do the majority of this walk on my own and really find myself, even though I was 58 at the time. But yeah.
Okay. How did you then feel with that time spent alone? What did that do for you, and kind of what was the and as you use this word, it's probably the wrong word, so it's used in such a grand way and it often doesn't need to be grand, but what was the kind of transformation for you from having that time alone on the trail?
To be honest, it was really being at peace with myself, because as well as everything, being in awe of everything you see and really appreciating what we have around us and the little things, you know, whether or not that's just the sun, even the rain. Just the reason we've got such beautiful green grass is because it rains a lot, but it's seeing that beauty. So that was that side of things. But for myself, I didn't listen to music. I was totally in my head. And that was quite good because I'd play over loads of stories in my head, different scenarios. I'm a great possibility thinker. So a lot of it was, oh, well, I can do this and I can do that. So my whole confidence and ease was really good. So the biggest transformation for me was the fact that I was happy and content with myself. I haven't been happier than I have been the last 3 years, or certainly the last, no, not even 3 years, last year and a half since I did that coastal walk. I'm so in the right zone for me. I don't let things get phased. And yeah, so in that respect, it was very transformational, even though it is a bit cliched.
Yeah, it is a cliched word because I think it's just so overused. You know, transformation obviously is attached so frequently to this idea of sort of having a profound life change when, you know, it doesn't always need to be that. It can just be a small change. Things can transform in small ways. But it's interesting how you, giving you that time freedom, just allowed you to really be yourself. And what I'm curious to know is, you were out for 11 weeks during that walk, and you say here that you also raised money for charity.
Yes.
And that was £5,000, which was then doubled to £10,000 for the Ocean Generation.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little about a bit about the charity aspect of the walk and where that played into it. But I'm also curious to know about the amount of time you had out from that and where kind of your work enabled you to then have that amount of time out from the walk.
Okay. So the company I work with, they had their charities Ocean Generation. So, and anything we raise, they will double. And it just happened to be that year. And I thought, wow, that's so in line with who I am and what I stand for. And walking the coastal path, what better charity could I support? And going backwards, this isn't the first time I've done environmental stuff. When my kids were young, I used to promote real nappies rather than disposable nappies. Mm-hmm. So I was a very strong advocate with that.
Yeah.
I'm disappointed that 25 years later, there doesn't seem to be much change.
No.
In respect,
well, it's a growing movement. There's more people doing it than there were, but yeah, it's still there's not a great
in the scheme of time. 25 years when, because that's the age of my son. So yeah. I know the age of when it was, and you still go into supermarkets. There's still none there. But
I'll tell you why. Quick diversion, because the companies who sell them are really, really bad at marketing their product. Yeah. There is a really big opportunity for a company to come along and market that in a way where it's affordable and easy, and no one's done that just yet. And I think that'll really help, like really making aware of some TV adverts, because people go, oh, dirty child's nappy that I have to wash. That is the most disgusting thing in the world. Like, you put it in a machine and it comes out spotless. So what's the problem? But, you know, we were there when we first started. That was all our questions. But there's no business who's doing it that well. They're all like mom and pop shops who kind of, you know, sew them on the side and stuff, or get a few cheap ones from China. So anyway, diversion. That's one of my reasons why I think they haven't really taken off that well yet.
Yeah, but it's still perception of what people think about them. Else said, but yeah, diversion. But so going back to Ocean Generation, it was just aligned with what I was doing. And, you know, walking the coast just made sense, really, as far as I was concerned. So interesting enough, I met a lady about a month later, and she had a banner for what she was raising. I thought, oh, that's a good idea. So I managed to call up some of my connections and wangle them to create a banner for me and then send it to me. So that was brilliant at helping raise funds. And I was totally in awe of the amount of people I met on the path who donated. So they'd
really?
See the banner.
So as you were walking, they'd actually kind of sign up there and then. Wow.
And they'd either give me cash or they'd take my QR code and put it on that. So I probably raised, out of my 5,000 or just under 5,000, well over £1,500 just by people on the path. And that was after a month, so I'd missed a month's opportunity. So that was amazing. And what that helped me was actually talking to people, because people said to me, aren't you get lonely or at night? And I found that actually that was the best way for me, because that banner, which said walking 750 miles, as it happened to be more than that, but at the time that's what I thought I'd be running, stimulated masses of conversations, and it was that helped my social aspect. And then at home or at night time, I was happy to be have peace and quiet and be back with myself. So it was a really good balance.
That sounds like an amazing experience, and what an achievement as well, for both personal and also raising that amount of money and then having it doubled for a charity that you know connected with in such a profound way. By this time then, you know, back in 2019 when you did this, you obviously had set course on being able to work for yourself, hadn't you? So you were able to take this time out because you worked for yourself. Is that right?
So
I think that's a really important part of your story. And I'm going to just use this as an opportunity, because there is more walking and things that you've done. And I guess we'll touch on that in a minute. But I think this is a really good part to talk about, the fact that you have what so many people would like to have, which is time freedom. feel free to explain how you do this. And also, you're welcome to mention the company you work for as well to enable you to do this, because there's so many options as to how people can have time freedom. But I think that in a world of possibility, because there is so much possibility of how this is doable now, we're still told that, you know, you have to do the thing where you have to work 40-hour weeks until you're 70 and then drop dead. And you, if you're lucky, you might have a chance to pursue your dreams then. But you've obviously bucked that trend. Can you go a little bit into that, like what you do and how that played out for you?
Yes, of course. Thank you. So as I mentioned, my mum introduced me to that, or this business, and it was quite a few years ago. And I took it very part-time because I understood the concept of the company I work with, which is UW, and it's about services. So the nice thing about services, they're all essential things. And so over the years, again, always part-time, I have introduced, you know, and helped people save money, basically. I help people save money on their essential services. And then I show people how to help their friends and family and connections save money on essential services. And that's basically it. And then over time, we get paid a royalty type income. So you do the work once and we get paid time and time again. And that's what creates that time freedom. So
Let's go into that. I'm interested. I'm just learning about these things, and I apologize for anybody who this is just no interest whatsoever, but you know what, I'm gonna ask, it's my podcast. So explain to me exactly how that works. So UW Utilities Warehouse, I think most people won't have associated UW with Utilities Warehouse, but now I've said Utilities Warehouse, people will go, oh yeah, that company. So exactly how does it work? So if I am somebody you have approached to try and save money on my household bills, go through the process and how that turns into income for you that allows you to kind of have that time and financial freedom.
Okay, so if someone was to become a customer, you become a customer, you would save money because obviously you wouldn't come over to us if that wasn't going to be the case. And in this environment at the moment, we can definitely save people lots of money. However, but how we get paid, after a while, we get paid a percentage of everyone's bills. So it's only a small amount, but over a period of time, that's how we get paid. And we get paid both on our personal customers, but also a much smaller percent on people we've helped. So that's where the residual comes.
So as long as somebody, so say if you capture a customer, you bring them over to Utilities Warehouse, they then do they move all their bills over, like their gas, electric, internet, everything?
That's the best option for everyone for two reasons. It helps them most and it helps them, and they stay put.
Yeah, sure. So so say then I've moved my gas, electric and internet over to Utilities Warehouse. You would, and you make an initial amount on that sale?
Or a certain initial amount. And that varies.
As long as I'm a customer, actually, I'm not going to expect to reveal numbers. As long as I'm then a customer, you're then continually making money monthly from the amount which I, as long as I'm that customer. Plus, you then make a bit as sort of from the collective customer base of Utilities Warehouse.
Exactly.
So as they grow, then the amount you earn grows as well with that.
Yes. It's about helping people. And that's really where I am at the moment. It's really helping a lot of people do a little, and whether or not they come on board just for a short period of time or whether or not they come on board like myself for, you know, a long time, because I want to have that time freedom. Yeah. Everyone joins for different reasons.
That's interesting. And how do you go about getting people to join then? Do you have to sort of knock on doors? Do you just find people online? Do they bring you customers? How does that work?
There's lots of different ways, but the best people is word of mouth. And, you know, even on my walk, people would say, well, how are you being able to take so much time off work? And, you know, I gathered a few customers and partners on route because it was a natural conversation. And that's what we were able to do. But there are lots of different ways which we would go to help people how to do that. But ultimately, it's word of mouth. That's how the company wants to grow. That's the most efficient way. And then you get referrals from that. And, you know, even now with what's happening at the moment, I regularly get probably a couple of referrals every week. from my existing customers, which is great.
Wow, that's really interesting. And you obviously started doing this because your mum did this. Like, how long was it something you kind of slowly eased into from your full-time work?
Yeah, whilst my mum introduced it, she didn't actually do anything.
Oh, okay, sorry. Right.
Well, that's a logical assumption. But no, she liked the thought of it, but she didn't actually do anything. So, but I'm still grateful that she offered it to me, because I probably wouldn't have done this. I'd already been in the industry in a similar concept, but I was product selling. And the trouble with product selling, it's great products, but you have to keep reminding them to sell, but to buy. And also in a recession or when things are tight, that's the first thing which people aren't going to continue buying. So that's why I liked essential services. So yeah, I started it when the kids were young. As I said, it's a very different company then than it is now. And on a very part-time basis. I didn't do any work in the summer holidays because my time was with them. And it's, you know, but I've been continuous with it. But that's given it flexible. Everyone does it for different reasons. And for me, it was to be flexible around the children so I could be with them for all of those things which mums want to be, you know, for the sports day and the plays and receptions and everything. And it's been really good for that.
Wow. Okay. And now your kids, how old are your kids now?
23 and 25.
Okay, so brilliant. So they have officially grown up and, you know, I'm guessing at this point there's independence or moving towards independence.
Yes.
So that then allows you the time and opportunity to actually do stuff you want to do. So I'm really interested, like, how does it feel? Let's go there. How does it feel to actually be able to wake up in the morning and go, well, you can set your own schedule. You don't have to set an alarm. You don't have to be anywhere for anybody, because you are with this obviously totally your own boss. I'm assuming you don't have call-ins or have to check up on, you know, be checked up on or, you know, justify yourself, as long as, you know, it's really down to what you want to do. What does that do for you as a person? Does it allow you to live a relatively comfortable, stress-free life? Kind of walk us through kind of the reality of that.
Absolutely. Because I've actually built up a reasonable, you know, royalty type income, I don't have to get up, as you say. I'm not succumbed to the alarm clock or anything like that. And right now, as I said earlier on, I'm imbued. So I look at the weather and I think, right, I need to get out for 3 or 4 hours today or 2 or 3 hours today to capture the sunshine. And I just factor in what I do and just disappear for a lovely walk on the beach, which is why I'm down here, because it's just stunning.
Yeah.
And it's just beautiful. So no, and then if I want to have a few days off or something, I can do. And a typical example was recently with my son, actually, because I know we haven't done or touched what I did this year with my hiking, but I came back to, because the situation we were in with the cost of living crisis, so I felt I wanted to come back and help more people. However, my son said to me, Mum, I now want to do the Three Peaks Challenge. Now, he's a 25-year-old. So 3 years ago, we did the Three Peaks Challenge he did it, and I was the taxi service. So he did it in the 24 hours. But I said, I'd love to do it, but I don't want to do it in 24 hours. I want to enjoy it. So we agreed we would do that. And then he suddenly said, Mum, I want to do it now. So for me to be able to say, do you know what? I really want to spend that time with him, because those memories are not going to be replaced. And he might have done it on his own and I'd missed that opportunity for us to have that amazing time. So what we did was we each climbed the three mountains together and he cycled in between.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I know. And not only that, he took his bike up both Scarfell and Snowdon.
Oh, wow.
As well as hiking.
That's impressive.
So, and I was the support vehicle. But it was lovely to be able to say, you know what, yes, I can do it, and not have to worry that I'd already taken 11 weeks off this year and I was still able to say, yes, And also recognize that most 25-year-old boys don't want to spend time with their mum doing things together. So, you know, I'm very privileged that we both have a sense of adventure, and he's quite happy to do that while I'm still fit enough to.
That sounds really interesting. And you also work now to try and help people also have the same opportunity that you currently have in terms of kind of having that time freedom. Now, can you explain to me, what is your definition for you? What is time freedom? And how is that different to sort of financial freedom? Are they one and the same? Explain that kind of concept to me a little bit, how you see it.
Do you know what? They possibly are the similar. For me, time freedom is the most important thing. Financial freedom, I think I'm going to give an example of someone who works in a high corporate job. They, or even owns their own company, but they're still confined to time. They've got enough money, so financially they're not, they don't need to worry, but they're still committed time-wise. They can't suddenly say, I want to go off and play golf tonight or this afternoon. Or they can't say, if someone says to me, do you fancy going to Spain for a month? I can say yes. Not everyone can. So to me, that's what time freedom is being able to say yes when you want to, or someone says there's an opportunity, or to be with friends and family. And yeah, it's a choice. So when my mum was ill, it was really important to be able to spend that time with her those last few months. And again, time freedom allowed me to be able to do that because I wasn't subject to a boss complaining.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. And then how do you, you work to help people achieve that same thing? Kind of what do you do within that work to help others have that time freedom? Because that's under your own brand, Join Divina.
So, well, Join Divina is my brand because I'm looking for like-minded people who want to be able to enjoy. For me, it's the nature and outside. And so it's, you're going to connect with people who are similar to yourself. So that's why I've put that brand as such. But it's exactly the same thing. We just show, UW's got a straightforward training system, and we literally just show people how to do that. And it's developing their own why. It's why do you want to do it? Why do you want to create that time freedom? Why do you want a pension? Or, you know, all of those things. And so the Join Divina was originally set up because I wanted people to join me on my adventures, join me with my fundraising, and join me in the business, if you liked that concept of wanting to achieve that for yourself.
Amazing. So you're trying to build a community around the idea of having that kind of time freedom where you can use that in whichever way you can. Does it generally tend to be a sort of community more geared towards outdoorsy people just anybody? No,
it can be. No, totally anybody. I think when I first set it up, it was A, to differentiate myself from others to a degree, but also it was my first solo trip, so I wanted people to join me because I wasn't expecting to be on my own, and or I was, but I wanted people to come with me and give me keep me company as well.
So did you set that up then when you were doing the Southwest Coast Path?
I set it up probably about a year beforehand because I was trying to, I suppose, develop a community of like-minded people. And then when I was doing the Southwest Coastal Path, I found a lot of people would say, oh, where are you? Can I follow you? And I did do quite a comprehensive blog on that, so people would follow me on that with that. So yeah, I'd say go and find me on Join Divina. I'm on the Facebook page, and my website was exactly the same. So yeah, it was, and it's just easy because ideally I want people to join me in whatever way they feel want to.
That's super, super interesting. So with this freedom that you have, so what are your kind of plans for the future? What kind of trails are you looking at doing in, you know, the next couple of years?
Right. Okay.
And so, skiing in that as well. So feel free to drop that in as well, because I do know that's an important part of your life.
Definitely skiing. I absolutely love skiing. Yeah. So this year I did the Wales Coastal Path. So I started in Clevedon and I carried on all the way down to Chester. Interesting enough, pretty much the same mileage I covered on the Southwest Coastal Path and from Clevedon, which was approximately 850 miles. I haven't done Anglesey yet, so this is what's going to happen next year. Because of various reasons, I left a month later than I wanted to. So it meant I ran out of time, really. Although I've got this time freedom, because of what happened in the market with the whole energy crisis, I wanted to come back.
Yeah, of course.
So I did do that. So next year, I have got the Anglesey to finish. So back on the Wales Coastal Path. So looking forward to that. I may even go into Snowdon area because I just absolutely fell in love with Wales and the mountains, the mountain back. So mountains and coast is amazing. So I've also going skiing in March, I think. And I've just started dancing. So this particular skiing is also dancing in the evening. So I'll be totally exhausted, but that should be fun.
Skiing during the day and dancing in the evening sounds absolutely shattering.
It does, but yeah. I'll worry about sleep when I get back. Yeah, so that's fine. Yeah. A friend of mine's just invited me to sail for a week, which I've not really done much sailing. I've been with her for a weekend. She's celebrating her 60th, so we thought we'd both do that together. And then I'm going hiking wise, I'm going to be doing the Haute route in Switzerland.
So what's it called?
The Haute, the high Haute. Route.
Oh, okay, right, amazing.
In Switzerland. So I want to go from Chamonix to Zermatt, which takes about 2 weeks, I think, that something like that.
Right, I've not heard of that particular route before. I'll have to have a look at it.
So it's a bit like the Mont Blanc trek, just slightly higher. I thought I'd go for that. So I'm really looking forward to that. And if I've got time as well, I want to do the West Highland Way. I know that's not coastal, which is my favourite.
Breaks the trend, yes.
I'd like to do that. But
it's mountains, so.
It's mountains. And to be honest, I drove through that when I went from Ben Nevis to Scarfell. So, and it was beautiful, even in the rain. So I'd like to do that as well. And if I've got any time in top of other things as well, then I will probably do a little bit more around the coast, either from Poole round or from Chester round, because I like to be continuous.
So that's really interesting, and I'm impressed and in awe of the amount of stuff and the lust for life that you have, and the kind of the buckets that you're filling, full of ticked things, essentially. So what kind of words would you have for anybody who's listening to this who, and I think it's going to be quite a few people who love hiking, love the outdoors, love adventure, and just want to be able to do more of it, but feel, well, you know what, I've got a job, I've got commitments, I've got family, you know, what advice would you have for those people with, and maybe help them see the possibility beyond having to work 9 to 5 for the next kind of 30, 40 years?
So, yeah, well, first of all, just do what you can, because life is short and you don't want to keep waiting for 10, 15 years before you do something. And that's really key. But the other thing is find something which you can do part time alongside with what you're doing. And that will give you options, whatever those happen to be, whether or not that's doing what I do, or there's plenty of other, and the term at the moment is side hustles. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, it's doing something alongside with what you're doing. Because although we work full time, you've still got 10 hours a week, which you can do something else alongside and build up that option for the future. But it's really important to follow your dream and don't let things stop you.
Amazing. All right. So where can people find out about you?
So the best place is my main website or Facebook. I am on Instagram, but not as much as I should be. And it is Join Divina. So it's joindivina.co.uk. And my handle, is that the right word?
For
both Instagram and Instagram and Facebook is Join Divina. And then obviously if you're on LinkedIn as well, then it's just Davina Farah, and which is my full name.
All right, fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today, Davina. It's been really nice to speak to you, and thank you so much for sharing your story with so much honesty as well.
That's great. Thank you.
All right, thank you.